If you're a Big Bang Theory fan, you know what's going on. If you're not, let me give you just a little bit of background to that clip. We just thought this really fit with what we're talking about this morning. All through the series, if you don't know the whole gist of the story, there's four guys who are friends who are all brilliant scientists, but Sheldon, the guy who had that wonderful throat singing adventure there, is kind of the smartest of them all, and he knows it, and he's massively quirky, and he was the first one in that apartment, and Leonard moved in, and he, upon moving in or upon agreeing, gave him the roommate agreement, which, believe it or not, if you've been with us, this is going to make sense to you. He calls it a covenant that stipulates the conditions of their agreement. Those words, I saw a clip this week where that came out of his mouth, that this is a covenant that stipulates the condition of our relationship. And so if you were here last week, we said that's exactly what a covenant with God is, right? And so it lays down the rules, the laws that they have to abide by as they live as roommates and friends in this apartment, and they have to get along. And you heard some of those quirky rules, some of those quirky laws, including if any of them become a super, gain a superpower, they must pull the other one in as their sidekick. So if one of them becomes Batman, the other one gets to be Robin, right? Or if one of them becomes a zombie, the other one cannot kill them. Of course, in the agreement, it also includes the fact that Leonard will be pretty much become Sheldon's personal chauffeur, take him anywhere he wants to go, and is also responsible for a confirmation sniff, which will tell if questionable dairy products are edible or drinkable. If Sheldon ever produces an artificial intelligence that starts to take over the world, Leonard is obligated to help him crush and destroy that artificial intelligence. I love this. In one of the episodes, it tells him if any one of the roommates ever invents time travel, the first trip they make is back to 5 seconds after they met for the first time. And so in that episode, he's telling them that this is the agreement, that if you invent time travel, you have to come back to 5 seconds after this moment. And then they stop, and they're both looking around, expecting them to show up, which is kind of humorous. If one of them ever gets invited to go swimming at Bill Gates' house, he will take the other friend to accompany him. And so what you end up with is this kind of comical look at somebody who has a set of rules that says, if you're going to live with me, if you're going to be my friend, if you're going to be with me, here are the rules and you must live by them. And all through the series, Sheldon is pulling out the roommate agreement, reminding Leonard of the contract. Well, then later in the series, what happens is Sheldon gets a girlfriend, right? And then he writes the relationship agreement. Then he makes the same sort of deal with his girlfriend, Amy, and now they have a set of rules that say how often they go out on dates and when they get to hold hands and all this. And this is kind of how Sheldon sees the world. And here's why we thought this fit with this morning. Because when we talk about the laws of God, the Old Testament rules and laws and regulations, a lot of us, we will come to this feeling like, that's God. That's the way God functions. He's kind of a nutty roommate, a nutty being who has all kinds of these quirky rules that he wants me to live by. I can't really live by them, but he's like hovering over me as a God who is really ultimately kind of looking out for himself and trying to control the way I live, and he's got all these crazy rules to do that. And so we've been studying the book of Exodus. If you're here this morning for the first time, we've been reading this great Old Testament story that tells us about God's rescue mission, how God stepped into human history and rescued his people from slavery. He delivered them from this empire at the time, the Egyptians. They crossed the Red Sea on dry ground as God literally parted the waters in front of them, and they crossed through on dry ground, and God saved them. And now God has brought them to this amazing mountain where he is meeting with them. It is the same mountain where Moses, in the very early pages of this book, met God in this burning bush. And now they're back to where they started, and they're meeting God, and God is now saying, listen, I will be your God. You will be my people. And he is forming this covenant, this relationship. And he is saying, listen, with me as your God, with me as your true king, this is what it's going to look like for me to lead you, to be faithful, to love you. But this is also what it looks like for you to live with a different king. Now, these are people who live in a world where There's all kinds of crazy spiritualities, and people have all kinds of worldviews and all kinds of different approaches to the way they see the world and who their God is and the way they live their lives. And what God is trying to do with them is to say, listen, you have been loved by the one true God, the creator of everything. And God is saying to them, I am going to put you on display so that the world who is lost, who is far from me, who doesn't know who God is, will begin to look at you. And as they look at you, they will see that you are different and wonder why. And as they wonder why, as they look at you, they will begin to see the God who has saved you. And as they do, as the world looks at who the Hebrews are, sees how they are different from all the nations around them, it will create a thirst for what they have. And so he says, listen, I will be your God, you will be my people. And he lays down the covenant, which includes the rules that he lays out that says, this is what it looks like for you to live with me as your king. And we end up now with, first of all, the Ten Commandments, which a couple weeks ago, Weston got to share with us the meaning behind that and kind of preach through the implications of the Ten Commandments and why God gave them. And this morning, we're going to look at some of the wider range of laws. There's a whole section here, almost three chapters long, where it's just, you should do this, you should do this, you shouldn't do this, you can't do this. And it's just a myriad of kind of random, all over the place laws that look at, from one level, what their livestock are doing. And if one ox gores another, there's a section that deals with justice and issues of poverty, a section that deals with how they're to worship, what it looks like to come together at certain times and to remember the Sabbath. There's a section that deals with their personal relationships. There's a section that deals with as they have slaves, and we're going to talk about, because that's kind of one of the places where people go, whoa, 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 slaves, that's not cool. But I'm going to talk to you about that in just a minute. But it just addresses kind of a myriad of issues. And what we find is that as God lays out the scripture, the Old Testament, there are 613 laws in the Old Testament. And each of those 613 laws kind of find their basis in the first 10, the Ten Commandments. And these laws are given to these people who have been rescued by their God, who now God is saying, listen, you have a different God. You have a different king. That God has already acted for you. That God has already rescued you. That God has already saved you. Now, this is what it looks like for you to live with me as your God, and it will make you different from the nations who are pursuing anything and everything else as ultimate and divine in their lives. And this is what's hard. We don't believe this. But here's my goal this morning, just real simple. I want you to understand this morning that the law of God is for your joy. Now, we don't ever believe that. When we were three and mom said, don't touch that, we went, ah, I don't like you. I want to have fun. This is my life. I am pursuing this. Don't stop me, right? We've never believed that any set of rules is for our joy. But as parents, we know that when we look at our kids and we're giving them instruction, most of the time, not all the time, sometimes we lay down rules so I can sit and watch Big Bang Theory and not be bothered, right? But most of the time, when we are dealing with laws, when we're laying down rules for our kids, we know that we can see the world differently, and our rules are for their joy, because it will not be fun to stick your finger in that light socket, right? It will not be fun to touch that hot burning stove. It will not be fun. It is for your joy that I tell you, do not chase that ball out into the street. You don't understand that yet. You don't know it's not for your joy. I know it's for your joy to not get hit by a car, right? And so we don't believe this from the get-go. And in America, we kind of have this two-pronged look at all the rules of the Old Testament. And how do we interact with these? And you have one section of America right now who is kind of doing this whole Christian America, who are going back to the rules of the Old Testament. And what they're standing up is they're trying to shake their fists at our culture, going, we must come back to these rules. We must come back to these laws. We have to put them on our courthouses. We have to put them in every government building. Everybody needs to know these. And we're only going to be right if we get the whole nation to come back to these laws. That's our goal. And so we're going to pass laws in our state legislatures. We're going to push for certain values. And there's a whole section of America that is saying, listen, we must return to the laws of the Bible if we are going to be blessed by God. Then you have a whole nother section of America who looks at the laws of God and the people who hold value in these and who believe in these on any level, and they say, listen, salvation is really casting them all off. Because what you have here, if anything, is just an ancient document by a group of weird people who lived at a specific time. They don't have any value for us today. But more than that, our freedom is being allowed to have personal autonomy and live however we want. We don't want anybody telling us what to do. And we want to live our lives in such a way that listen, I don't want a God or anybody else telling me what to do. I know what will make me happy, and just let me pursue it on my terms. And anybody who steps into this will all of a sudden be the enemy, right? It's like this all came to a head in Indiana this week, right? If you haven't been paying attention, Indiana passed a religious discrimination law, and you have one side saying, yes, we're coming back to the place where religious freedom means that Christians can stand up and believe what they want and hold what they want and feel what they want, and we can kind of share our beliefs and nobody can stop us. And the whole rest of the world is now trying to boycott Indiana because they think it is all about discrimination and that religious people exercising their view over everybody else, and it is an infringement on personal autonomy and discrimination. And the world looked at Indiana and said, like even the mayor of Seattle is now saying nobody from Seattle can travel to Indiana. And if you do, you'll lose your job. Because Indiana passed the law that is actually held by 19 other states. So they become the 20th state to have a similar law. So like both sides, now here's my point, both sides are looking at this, and it goes all the way back to how should we live our lives, and we're gonna say, well, we should live it according to the laws of God. This is the response. But the funny thing is often the Christian worldview who will stand up and say, well, we must return to this. If you sat down and said, list the Ten Commandments, they'd get about three of them, right? And so there's this weird reconcile. And so I want you to understand that the law is for your joy. But to get to that point, I got to explain to you, like, we got to take a step back and look at the law from a 30,000-foot viewpoint. I'm not going to try to teach you what each and every law in this section of the Bible means. What I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to take a 30,000-foot viewpoint of the law, the rules in the Bible, and to help you see why God put them there and what is it leading us to. Because the law has a goal in your life this morning. And if we take side one and we say, okay, we're just going to cast them off because the law is a violation of my personal autonomy, we're missing something great. But I'm telling you, if we take side two and we say, listen, the goal here is to make sure that everybody in the world lives by these laws, we're missing the point on that too. There's something vastly different that the law is trying to accomplish in you and me. When God, every time God says, thou shalt not, God is trying to accomplish something in your life that is much greater than just you keeping that rule. And we can't ignore them, but we also can't try to rule and find, like, make the basis of my own acceptance or the acceptance of others to God on these rules. And we already talked about this last week, that the rhythm in the Bible then is that God always rescues and redeems. He acts for his people, and then he brings them into a relationship, and then he gives them rules. That most of us in a religious worldview think it's rules, then redemption, and then maybe a relationship. What happens is that if I keep the rules, God will like me, and if God likes me, maybe somehow he'll save me. And what we've already tried to declare is that the gospel is just the opposite, that God loves us. He has rescued us from our sin and our slavery to ourselves. He has brought us into a relationship with himself because of Jesus and the cross, and out of that, he is now going to change our lives. That the keeping of any rule in the Bible, any imperative in the Bible, must follow first what God has done for us. And if we get that rhythm backwards, we're going to ruin the gospel. And when we ruin the gospel, we're actually teaching people how to go to hell in their own goodness. And that's a very dangerous thing. And so we must understand that all these rules, first of all, flow out of God's work and his love for us. And it is for our joy. So Psalm 1 is this crazy, amazing, is the writer of the Psalms and the people who put it together, put together this hymn book, this song book of songs and poems and prayers for the Hebrew people. Psalm 1 says something that's very interesting about the law. Look at this. In Psalm 1, it says, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. Verse 2, but his delight is in the law of the Lord." Now listen to what he says. He doesn't say, blessed is the man who goes and keeps the law, who goes and does everything in it. He says, blessed is the man whose delight is in the law. You ever think about that? That what we're saying here this morning is that you ought to delight in the law of God, that you ought to find joy and beauty in the law of God. And on his law, he meditates day and night. The person who does that is like a tree planted by streams of water and yields its fruit in season, and its leaf does not wither, and all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but they are like the chaff the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgments, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. What I want you to see out of that is him saying, it's not just, listen, go keep the law, because there's a way to go do what God has commanded, but do it out of a sense of duty so that it's a treasury. But it is your duty that you must do these things. And the psalmist is saying, blessed is the man who delights in the law. How do we get to the point where we look at what God has commanded us and it brings a delight? To get there, we must understand why the law is in the Bible. So to do that, grab your Bible and let's look at Exodus. Let's look at a few of these laws, show you the laws a little bit as God lays them out. Understand that in chapter 21 through 23, we're not going to read all these. We're just going to hit a few of them. But as we read them, then I'm going to take the 30,000 foot view and we're going to start talking about why are they there? Why are the laws in the Bible? So Exodus chapter 21, page 53 and 56. If you are grabbing a Bible at the end of your rows, if you're here this morning, you don't have a Bible, that's our gift to you. Please take that with you and just use that to read and learn about what God has said to us. If you have an app, you can find it there, Exodus 21. And verse 1 says, "Now these are the rules that you shall set before them." There it is. Here's the rule book. And what happens, though, is we read the Bible and we think that's what it is. It is God's great rule book. I'm an umpire, right? I umpire high school, college level baseball, and I know how to read rule books. I'm a rule hound. I study and memorize rule books so that when I'm on a baseball field and something quirky and weird happens, I can literally quote the rule to a coach. And I've had several times where a coach comes out and goes, "I don't think you have that right." And I will say, "Hey, listen, Section 8, Rule 3 says this." And they'll go, "Oh, okay," and then just walk back to the dugout, because that is my job as an umpire. I have to know the rules inside and out. And so what we do is we often come to the Bible with a cultural framework to say the Bible is God's rule book. Well, let me set that aside this morning and explain just one simple issue. How many laws are there? I told you this already. How many laws in the Old Testament? 613 laws. It is estimated that there are well over 8,000 promises in the Bible. Now, the math ought to be simple to us, okay? If there are 613 times where God looks at his people and says, "Thou shalt," and over 8,000 times where God looks at us and says, "This is what I will do for you," the emphasis is not on the rules of what we do. The emphasis of the Bible is on what God has and is doing. The rules flow out of that. It is not, "If you keep my rules, I will keep my promises." God says, "Here's my promises. Now, because I've loved you, go live differently." And so our focus, the Bible is not a rule book. The Bible contains laws. It says so. Here's the rules. But the Bible is not primarily a rule book. It is a story of God's acts and his love and his grace and his intervention in our lives to rescue us from ourselves. So here are the rules that I said. Now let me show you a few of these. Flip over real quick to verse 16 of chapter 21. He says, "Whoever steals a man and sells him, And anyone found in possession of him shall be put to death." Now, here's one thing. We start reading the Bible, and the Bible starts to talk about laws for slaves. And that makes us uncomfortable because we know our country's history and even the story of slavery around the world. And we go, "Listen, slavery's bad." And there's a lot of language today that talks about slavery and says, "Look at the Bible. The Bible condones slavery." Let me just help with that. There is slavery in the Bible, but it's not like the ethnic-based slavery in our culture, nor is it like the slavery that happens around the world where one culture conquers another and forces them into all kinds of crazy servitude. That does take place in the Bible. And this law here forbids the Hebrews to ever be a part of it. So what is the slavery that takes place in a Bible? It is slavery that is based on economic conditions. The slavery that is talked about previously is in a world where there's not banks, there's not ways to borrow and lend money. And what happens is a family has a struggle and they cannot afford their debts. And so what they do is they will take their land and their trade and basically offer it to another person for a period of time. And the Old Testament is clear that period of time is 6 years. For a period of time so that they can not be responsible for the debts and they can give that trade to another person. It's more of an employer-employee relationship than it is a slave-master like we had. So yes, there are laws that say when this happens, when the economic reality is this, slaves, you're going to keep your end of the deal. When you have agreed to this sort of relationship, you're not going to take your master for granted. But masters, you cannot take slaves for granted either. And so there's all these laws that are kind of woven in that explain what that looks like. But then we come to this verse that says, listen, you can't steal another person and sell them off. And if you do, you forfeit your life. So here's a good old boy with a Bible on one side, sitting on the table, selling off an African-American woman. The scripture clearly forbids and condemns that. That type of slavery is not okay. And if you bought the slave, you were on the hook too. Okay? So, different issue, but slavery is addressed here, okay? Another set of laws, chapter 21, verse 35. I love this one. When one man's ox butts another's so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and share its price, and the dead beast they shall also share. All right, so anybody have a problem with this week? Your ox butted another and it killed the ox. How are we going to deal with that, right? This is an issue like in my backyard every so often. So my point here, and by the way, I love how God says, all right, here's what you're going to do. Two guys own an ox and one butts the other. What we're going to do is we're going to sell the live ox and we're going to split the price. And with the dead one, we're going to go have a barbecue together. It's literally what he says you're going to do, right? There is beauty in this, right? But here's the deal. He's speaking to people in a certain culture with certain issues, and he's helping them govern their lives as a nation. And so there's this. Chapter 22, verses 16 through 25. Look at some of these laws, some of these commands that God gives. If a man seduces a virgin and is betrothed and lies with her, he shall give her the bride price for her and her and make her his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to that of the bride price for virgins. Now, let's just put this in simple, plain English, okay? The Bible holds marriage in very high regard and reserves sexuality for the context of marriage. And some dude takes a girl out and they go to Buffalo Wild Wings and have a few too many drinks and he ends up sleeping with her. The Bible didn't, in this story, it's not saying, hey, just go home, no big deal. It's saying, man, really, you've created a path. Marriage has already taken place. We're going to honor marriage, okay? Let's keep going. You shall not permit a sorceress to live. Whoever lies with an animal shall be put to death. That's just weird, okay? Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord shall be devoted to destruction. You shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. In other words, if there's somebody who is from a different land, a different nation who comes to you, you must treat them like they are your family and your friends. You don't treat them poorly. You shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. Now we have issues of justice. We are going to treat broken people in our culture with great care. And we're not going to mistreat them. We're going to be kind to people who are living in poverty. For I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. And God's just giving this blanket warning. Listen, if you become a culture that doesn't care for the broken things of the world, I will pull my presence away from you and let you suffer like they do. If you lend money to any of my people and who is poor, you shall not be like a moneylender to him, and you shall not exact interest from him. Now, and so here's what it says. If you're going to loan money, you should not start charging your countrymen interest. Now, here's the deal. We start reading this, and then the big question is, how much of this are we supposed to keep? And we're going to talk about that in great detail, but one of the things I want to explain to you real quickly this morning is that God is speaking to Israel that exists as three separate relationships with each other and with their God. The first relationship is as a redeemed people. And God is telling his people, this is what it looks like to live as holy people who have me as your God. The second relationship is as worshipers who have got, who are going to come and gather in the tabernacle and come together and worship and celebrate festivals. And God teaches them as worshipers that they do not take his presence lightly, that when they come to him, they're to come to him with certain values and attitudes and even certain ways. And so there are a whole bunch of laws that address how they worship, how they remember the Sabbath, how they celebrate festivals. But they are also a nation. They're also a nation, which means they also need laws that govern themselves as a nation. And as a nation, they're to understand that God is their true king. And so how do we interact with these? How do we wrestle with the fact that the laws are on these three levels? Well, first of all, I will tell you flat out that once we get past Jesus, the New Testament people of God is the church, and the church is never to be a nation. We are never to organize ourselves so that we create our own laws and create our own little subculture. What we are to be is the people of Christ in the world at large. And so things like, you know, when he starts laying out the punishment, like some of the capital punishment issues, the church should never see itself as the arm to exercise those. That is the job of the government. And in this situation, the government and the people of God are one. But in our situation, the government and the people of God are separate. And we should not try to take on ourselves things that are literally given to the government, but in the Old Testament, they're mixed a lot more tightly. And so that's one of the problems we have when Christians start claiming that, you know, banging this, we must create a Christian government. We're in a world, now I'm not saying Christians shouldn't have influence in the government, don't mishear me here, but the church is not to carry out the punishments that are really given to the government to do. Okay? And so how do we interact with this? How do we deal with these laws? How do we go through and see all these thou shalts and thou shalt nots, make sense of them? And what I'm going to do, and this is going to happen really fast, speed of light, right? I have an 8-point sermon. You're like, oh my gosh. We're going to try to wade through these 8 points really fast. But what I want to do is I want to take these thou shalt nots, the law, and I want to pull back to a 30,000-foot view, and I want to say, is the Bible then says, why has God done this? Why has God given us his law? I want to show this to you and hopefully give you a different perspective on the rules so that you find joy and you become a person who delights in the law of God. Okay? So, 8 points. Number one, 8 biblical reasons God has given the law. Number one, it demonstrates the character of God. In other words, one of the things that happens when we read the law of God is we find out that God is a moral being, that God is a personal God, that he is one, that there's not many gods. There is one God who is both the creator and the sustainer and the lawgiver. We find out that his character is perfect. He is holy and just and righteous. In fact, the title of the sermon is The God Who Is Holy. We've been talking about the character of God all through this series. And what we learn from the law is that God is a God who is holy, perfect in his goodness and his morals and his character, his righteousness. And the law points us to not only who God is, but God who is perfect and holy must set a standard for his beings. And so this God is calling us to holiness. We have a God who is holy, and in his holiness, he is expecting the perfections of this. And so what we find here is that we have to understand, as we read the law, who gave the law? These are not man-made commandments. God is the one who gave the commandments, and he gave them to his people who are in a relationship with him, and they're to lead them to his God. Now, several years ago, there's a big controversy when Roy Moore in Alabama decided to put the Ten Commandments in the or put them back in the court in the courthouses around Alabama. And hear me this, because some of y'all are going to freak out at what I'm about to say. I don't care if we do that, but I am telling you that is not the purpose for the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments were not primarily given to tell the world how they should live. The Ten Commandments are a template that begins to teach the people of God what it looks like to have God as their king. And the issue is not, will my neighbor who doesn't know God begin to live by the commandments? The issue is, will the people of God begin to obey God because he has saved them? And so what we often try to do is we try to take the Ten Commandments down the street and put it in front of the courthouse, but the very people who claim to know God are not honoring what God has said in their lives. And when we don't honor him, what it really tells us is that we don't really understand who he is. He's a good, gracious, benevolent God who has our best in mind. And he has given us the law to reveal his character. And even in giving the laws, his character is a God who is working and acting for our joy. And as we miss and we don't live under his commands as the people of God, it's to our detriment. It's not for our good. And as we stray, we will find brokenness in our lives. And so it demonstrates the character of God. Number two, it's for the holiness of his people. So God is holy, is for the holiness of people. Now, read people there as I intended. That is plural. In other words, what happens is that God gives the Old Testament people these laws, and as a nation, as they generally live by those laws, they're going to look different from the nations around them because the nations around them don't care about things like adultery and about certain food laws, and they don't care about other things. And all of a sudden, as a people, they're living their lives in a totally different way than the nations that surround them, and God is changing them corporately as a people through the laws that he has given them, and they keep it together as a group. Now, often we say, well, what does that look like in our own life? Should I keep the law of God? And the answer is yes and no. On one level, yes, God is calling us to live like this, but on the no level, we don't. And we find this in the Hebrew people that kind of corporately there are seasons where they return to the law. We see them changing like God says they should because of the law. But most of the time, they're running headlong away from God going, we really like those people over there and how they're partying. And so we're going to run away from what God's law is. And then the prophets say, listen, we must return to the law of God because he has made us his people. He has saved us. He has rescued us. And so it's for the holiness of his people. So that leads us to number three. The third reason that God has given us his laws, it is to protect and provide for God's people. To protect and provide for his people. In every negative commandment, there is either personally or corporately both two positive principles. Every negative commandment is there, it both protects God's people and provides something for him. Like one of the crazy ones in the Old Testament is that they can't eat pork and catfish, and there's all these dietary laws that we look at like and go, oh, I'm so thankful for Jesus, we get bacon, right? You know, and we go, why would God tell them not to eat pork? Well, listen, we live in modern times where the pork industry has figured this out, but if you ate pork in ancient times, it'd kill you if you didn't cook it right, right? So what does it look like for God to go, you know, you might want to avoid these things, it might kill you. Love you. I know it tastes good, but I know best. See, it just that's just a simple illustration how we often can't see things in front of us, and God is just loving us and caring for us, even though we look at it and go, hey, my autonomy is for my joy. God's saying, no, it's not really that way. And he protects and provides for his people through the law. But those first three make it sound like so therefore you must keep the law. What happens is, though, as I read the law and I begin to wrestle with the fact that the very rules that I'm called to love and delight in are the very rules that I break, and I look at the culture around me and say, here's the Ten Commandments, you should live by them, but then in my own life, I know I don't. So how do I wrestle with this? And the rest of these, the last five, are literally how the law leads us to something else, and this is how I delight. I know that it shows me God. It shows me who my God is. And so like the law, thou shalt not lie, is ultimately teaching me that I have a God of truth. It is for the holiness of his people. As we as a church live under God's commands, it's going to change us as a people. We're going to look different from the world. God's laws protect and provide for us. But at the end of the day, we don't do these things. So what is the law there? If the law literally says thou shalt not and nobody then keeps them, it leaves us guilty. How do we deal with this? And so number four, the law is there to reveal our guilt and give us knowledge of sin. To reveal our guilt and give us knowledge of sin. The New Testament, an author, a guy named Paul, who we're going to read a lot of verses he wrote here in this, Paul says this, Romans chapter 7, verses 7 through 9. He says, what shall we say then? That the law is sin? By no means. Yet if it had not been for the law, I would not have known sin. For I would not have known what it is to covet if the law had not said, you shall not covet. But sin, seizing the opportunity through the commandment, produced in me all kinds of covetousness. For apart from the law, sin lies dead. I once was alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin came alive and I died. Now listen to what Paul's saying. Paul is saying, is not saying that before I read the commandment, I never coveted. Coveting is interesting. The last of the Ten Commandments, because everything else is like, thou shalt not kill. You're like, dude, I ain't whack nobody. You know, I'm good with that, right? Then you say, thou shalt not covet, and all of a sudden you're not dealing with something that's external. You're dealing with an issue of the heart. You're like, dude, that Mustang on the parking lot that I drove by. Oh, man, if I just had that car, my life would be awesome, right? And you begin to deal with the deep desires of your own heart, even if you never live them out. Here's what Paul's saying. He's not saying, I never coveted until I read the Ten Commandments. What he's saying is, my heart was full of this. I want this, I want this, I want this. And when do we start that? We start it like as soon as we're walking, right? I mean, just put a kid in a room and they're going to find something shiny that says, I must have, I must have. And they're wandering around a house searching after the things that they have determined will make their life work at that moment. We spend the rest of our life doing this. And Paul says, but then I read the Ten Commandments and I went, it said, thou shalt not covet. And see, that's what it works, right? Adding a law makes me go, I'm done with that. Like, that worked with our kids, right? Remember having the talk when they were about 7 and go, listen, your life is not about stuff. You know, it's not about having the best video game. It's not about having, you know, all the shiny new things. It's not about having the best sports equipment. We're okay. We just need to be content with what God gives us. We're having that conversation with my twins right now. And I just want to let you know that every time we look at our twins and say, listen, we just want to let you know life is not about our stuff. We should be content. The response of my twins is always, oh, that's right, Mommy and Daddy. We know that, and we are content with what we have. Yeah, y'all are laughing because you're like, you know, they look at us, they're like, okay, but I want that. I mean, like, this is the beating drum of our life with our six-year-olds. And adding the law to the mix isn't doing anything about their heart. It just shows them that their heart needs a savior, right? That's what Paul says. Paul says, when I learned thou shalt not covet, what I learned, first of all, is that I do, and second, the commandment made me covet more. You ever find that? And so what it does is it reveals our guilt and gives us knowledge of our own sin. It helps us to, like when I read thou shalt not, and all of a sudden I go, this is not me. All of a sudden I know I got a problem. God, who is holy, who is perfect, has given me a commandment, and I went, doing it my own way. I have a desperate problem if that God is truly God. And it is the law. This is why we love the law. The law begins to help us, show us daily. Like, before you meet Jesus, if you're here this morning and you don't have a relationship with Jesus, the beauty of the law is that it's really just there to show you that you need to be rescued. If you tomorrow morning start wake up and say, I am going to live my life by God's rules, you are going to stumble and fall on your face very quickly, and you're going to find that you can't. And you're either going to become a psycho-legalist who keeps everything you can and that gets proud, or you become a person who just throws off the law and says, well, I can't keep it, the heck with it, I'm going to live my life how I want to. And if you understand that the law is not there primarily so you will keep it, but primarily to show you that you can't, it will help you chart a path to loving the law because it leads you to something else, right? And so the law is there. These rules are there to give us, to reveal our guilt and give us knowledge of sin. Number five, to show us that our goodness and works cannot save us. To show us that our goodness and works cannot save us. Romans 3, verses 19 through 20 says this. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. Now here's same author, and here's what Paul's saying. When I look at the law, if I look at the law and then compare myself to you, it's possible that I'm way better than you. And therefore, I can go, hey, I'm better than, you know. And eventually, you're going to climb that ladder to the very most religious people. And when you get to the very most religious people, they can look down on everybody. But our tendency, like what we tend to do when we look at any set of rules, is we may say, I don't really keep these, but I'm better than those people. And we can justify ourselves. But when we're clear and we read the law like it really is, we say, listen, God has set a standard. No matter who we are here. And it leaves us in a situation where all of a sudden I realize, listen, my good works can't save me. That's what Paul's saying. I can't be good enough to rescue myself. And so the law is there to show us that our goodness and works cannot save. So what's the remedy to this? If the law is there, it says how I should live. If I don't live by that, if I can't even solve the condition, I can't remedy my own problem, what is the law there to do? Number six, the law was written to be fulfilled by Jesus in our place. And this is the big idea. I want you to hear this clearly. The law was put in the Bible as a job description. It was put in the Bible as a job description. Matthew chapter 5, verse 17 says this: "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." It was given to us as a job description, and here's what Jesus says. Jesus says, I didn't come to be the one side that just says, do away with the law. Nor did I come to be the side that says, we are going to hold the law up as something we beat everybody down with. I didn't come to abolish it. I didn't come to do away with it. I came to fulfill it. Here's what happens. The Old Testament starts laying out the law, 613 commands, and it's writing a job description. Very much like if you're a football fan, we recently had the NFL combines. We're coming up to draft day, right? For those of you who don't like Sports Illustrations, you can check out for a minute. For the rest of us that are okay with them, this is for you, all right? I've been told to limit them, so this is the only sports one this morning, all right? So here we go. What happens is the NFL teams know their needs, and they're like, all right, we need an offensive tackle. That's kind of what the Rams are talking, offensive. We're looking for a guy who's about 6'6", 320 pounds. It's mostly chiseled. He runs like a 4.5, 4.6, 40-yard dash. He can bench press 225 pounds about 30 times. I mean, they have a list of things they're looking for. They can look back at his college, you know, look back at guys' film, and they've created a criteria, a list of the things that they're looking for, so they will know they get the right guy in the draft, right? And what they find is almost everybody they look at, they're good at a couple things, but there's always something. They have a weakness and all this kind of stuff, but they have set a criteria by which they are judging everybody around. So here's what the Bible does. It's kind of the combine for spirituality, and it says, here is what God says, here's what we are looking for. And then you start reading the Bible, and every person who comes along is massively deficient. You think, okay, here's Abraham. He's that guy. Nope. Tries to sell his wife. He can't be the good guy, right? Here comes Moses. Nope, he whacked a dude. He killed a person. He gets mad and like even curses God a couple times. He's not the hero. Here's David. Nope, he ends up with this crazy, weird adultery situation where he gets one woman pregnant and then whacks her husband. I mean, there's just all, like, you keep thinking, here's the guy. And then you're like, here's the job description. This guy ain't the dude. And you read every story in the Old Testament, that's what you come to the conclusion. There's not one good person among them. And then Jesus comes along. And he lives for 30 years just in the quietness of his own home, growing up in a home where he is obedient to his parents, and he works as a carpenter in his dad's carpentry shop, just having a trade. And then he does his ministry, and multiple times Jesus looks at people, even in his own hometown, looks at people he grew up with and says, "Who of you can accuse me of sin?" Now, I can't say that in any setting. Like, I can't even be with my wife and go, can you accuse me of sin? She's got a list that's like 47 pages long. My kids can't say that. They couldn't say that by the time they were one. But Jesus looks at all these people who he grew up with and said, who of you can accuse me of sin? He is fulfilling the job description. But it's not just that he's doing it so Jesus could get to the end of his life and go, I'm better than all y'all. He is doing this so that he can do it for us. What the Bible is teaching us is the law of God is there to show us our need for Jesus. But Jesus lived the life I should have lived. And what God does is God gives us Jesus righteousness. So here's a question. Have I kept the law? Yes. You're like, I know you. No, you haven't. Hold on. I have kept the law in Christ. So that when the creator of the universe looks at me, his redeemed son, he doesn't look at me, he sees Jesus. He sees Jesus' record of perfection and not my broken life and my failure to keep the law. His fulfilling the law was representative for me. Jesus gave me his righteousness. But he had to be righteous first as a human. And so Jesus lives this perfect life and he fulfills the law. And that's what Jesus means. He says, I didn't come to abolish it, I came to do it. came to fulfill it. I came to be the one who keeps the job description. Number seven, why the law? Why? It's to lead us to Christ. Galatians tells us this. I won't read the verse. You can look it up. Galatians chapter 2, verses 24 and 25 tells us that the law is like a schoolmaster, a teacher that leads us to Christ. It's a guardian, okay, that leads us to Jesus. So here's the guardian, the schoolmaster, the guardian looks at us and says, all right, let's teach today. Here's the law. And we go, uh-oh. And then the schoolmaster of the law says, now, Jesus is our hope. So as a schoolmaster, it leads us to Christ, that the law literally is to take us to Christ. This is why I can delight in the law, because I look at the law and I go, what the law does is it makes my heart cry out for my rescuer, and daily it leads me to him. And this leads to the last thing, number eight, that the law then is written on our hearts as a result of the gospel. That what happens is that God gives the law and it shows us that he is a perfect, holy God, and then he rescues and redeems us, and he's still at work. And so the goal is that God is transforming our lives. I don't try to live in the purpose and the law of God in order to gain God's acceptance. I live in the and read what God commands me and do it because I have been loved by God and I want to love him back. So it's very much like marriage. Heidi and I got married 26 years ago. There's a lot of things that as we started through marriage, she was like, I see this in you, and I'm not real crazy about it. And most of the time, I dealt with those things in a godly, humble way. Kicking and screaming, mad. But what happened is I began to realize that because I love her, I don't mind doing what makes her happy, what brings her joy. That's what happens in the gospel, that I've been loved and redeemed by God, and now he says, this is the way I want you to live your life, and I begin to go, I love the law because it leads me back to the God who's rescued me and loves me anyway. And what I find is that the things that Heidi loves to do, I love to do those things because if I get to do them, I do them with her, right? She signed us up for a 5:30 a.m. Friday morning bicycling class. I crawl my butt out of bed at 4:30 because I get to be with her, not because I want to be on a bike at 5:30, right? So now I have a law. Thou shalt get up at 4:30 a.m. And it's a joy because by keeping the law, I grow towards her, right? That's the point. And what happens is God begins to build from the inside out his character. And so, blessed is he who delights in the law. Why? Because it leads me to Jesus, my need for him, and it leads me to how he wants to change me to be like him. That's why I love that. That's why the psalmist says, blessed is he who delights in the law. The band's going to head this way. And just as they come up and they lead us in worship, I want you to dwell on this and focus on anytime you come to a thou shalt not, just go, okay, in my own strength, I won't do this, but Jesus already has. I'm going to trust him and ask God to work his character into my life to transform me. John Bunyan said it like this. Run, John, run, the law commands, but the law gives me neither feet nor hands. Far better news the gospel brings. It bids me fly and gives me wings. If the law of God is something that leads to a treasury of duty, it is going to be an absolute failure. But if the law of God leads you to Jesus, it will begin to be your delight. Jesus, we love you today, and Lord, help us to love your law. Help us to fall in love with the commands that you have given us, because we know that the very law both builds in us something beautiful, but more than that, it leads us to you who kept it for us and then keeps it in us. Help us this morning to understand that and to be moved by that. In your name I pray. Amen.